Hello, cherubs, and welcome to another episode of Fitness Unfiltered. How are we all? Can we start with Mike today, this week? We'll start with Mike, not the guest. The guest can hold on because he needs a bigger intro.
Let me say, I am fine.
Okay, sorry.
Big M. I'm also fine.
And we are also joined by the OG, not own goal, maybe original gangster. He referred to it as something else on his story today, which I'll let him introduce himself as. Mr. Luke Johnson, how are we?
I'm very good. Thank you, people of Luke here, who wants to talk in third person. No, we're not going to do that, are we? I refer to OG as old git.
Old geezer.
Yeah, or old geezer would sound, probably be a fitting description based on my South East London Cockney accent.
So, I don't think we should go with that, though, because we're the same age. So OG. Mm. And I say OG because you've been around a bit.
That sounds terrible.
Well, but you know.
I think a lot of people in the fitness industry have been around a bit.
They've done a bit of everything. They've specialised in a few things.
Yes. Yeah, I suppose.
We've all been around a bit now.
Yeah.
But I first met you, Luke, at Performex recently, which seemed odd to me because I've kind of known who you are for a very long time, and you were very kindly
long distance away.
Yeah, long distance social media friends.
Yeah,
and I feel like Luke was the Dorian Yates of actual fitness online coaching business. He's just been away in his dungeon, shunning away the rest of the fitness industry.
I don't get that quote. I don't know.
I don't get the what makes one the Dorian Yates of something.
Yeah.
Or fitness. Well, Dorian Yates was a very famous bodybuilder.
But what qualities of his make him similar to Luke?
He was very, very successful in his field. Right. He was known for being very, very focused, not being involved in anyone else's business, but just doing what he does very well. So I thought that was a very apt description.
Yeah.
Because I've known you. Look, he's shaking his head. Take the compliment, man.
That's a good example. I'll be honest with you. You've done well.
Later. Yeah, I know. No, I know. And I know. But what, we met in what, like 2012?
Who did you meet first?
Out of what? Everyone here.
Yeah.
I know who's the last one. It was Dr. Mike. And now, like, we just, I don't know. It's just like a romance.
You know what? Actually, I have a little claim to Luke fame.
Go on.
I started kind of Luke's first podcast. Well, yes. That was my first podcast.
Yeah. So I think I met Dan first. Because Shredded by Science didn't start until 2013.
Okay.
Yeah, I think you were still doing a bit of lecturing actually when we met, weren't you? Still doing a little bit still.
Yeah, I think I don't know if you want to mention someone's name, and then we all met up for something that didn't go anywhere. So that was the first time I met Dan.
Whose name was it?
Another person called Dan.
Oh, right.
Yeah.
You know what? There's a few. What's the guy from Harry Potter? You're not meant to say his name.
Voldemort.
There's a few of them in the fitness industry now. I was wondering which one it
was. Oh, yeah. So Dan first. And then I remember seeing Dan. It was when Dan was wanted to be like a physique athlete. So I just remember his little shorts on and his physique. And then, yeah.
Take little shorts, not little physique. That's fine.
It was pre-first child, Dan, was it, that we met?
Yeah.
It must have been just before.
I think you were expecting your first.
Yes. Yes. I didn't give birth. My partner gave birth, but I was expecting, just to clarify that. I'm not superhuman. And then, ESG was yourself, Lawrence Judd, and Army Leg. And that podcast had over a million downloads.
What's Army Leg?
That's the person.
Yeah, oh. How would you actually pronounce his name, Emma? Would that be it? Or...
I mean, me and pronunciations are not...
Well, and myself. His name's Arm. He's in the army and he has legs, okay? Army Leg. He was this like young 19-year-old sort of just came on the scene and... Pardon?
I think he does a lot of copywriting now, or ghostwriting.
Yeah. So he was one of these young kids that came sort of just emerged on the fitness Facebook blog. Was it his Facebook that back then? And he was just like really in one of those smart kids. But he, what stood out for me is I actually thought his voice on his podcast was like computer generated, but no, that was his actual voice. He did sound like a robot.
What a compliment.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, it's like, you sound like someone reading an audiobook, which isn't an actual person. And yeah, I didn't listen to any episodes of the SBS radio. So thank you very much, ESG, for over 1 million downloads. Yeah, it was the free, use free that.
You know what? I think that was one of the first, I mean, certainly wasn't one of the first podcasts ever, but like one of the first decent fitness podcasts. I'll claim to fame there.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was one of the first I listened to.
The audio quality was horrendous because we actually did do it on our phones. But actually, some of the guests we got on, I'm sure we had Spencer Nadalski on.
Yeah.
Had really good topics. And at the time, I was working in cardiovascular disease, so I got to talk about loads of that stuff. Anyway, it was...
geeky-esque type training, nutrition. Far more complex topics that my tiny little brain would comprehend. So it was that's why I didn't really get involved with that side of things. I suppose it was Dan, ESG, and then Dr. Mike.
Well, you know, your first year, that's probably a good place to start, because there wasn't, when you first started doing online coaching, there wasn't as many blueprints promised. There wasn't certain things that people now focus on. And we thought it'd be really interesting for the sake of the listener to kind of venture back to when you first started, what stood the test of time and what's gone but should be back and where we think we're going with it.
You're probably going to have to like preempt me with some of those because I will forget.
So, oh yeah, don't worry, I'll forget as well. I just made that up.
At the time of online coaching, there was Luke Hazlett that was doing it and it was premium, but it'd send everyone the same plan through with other people's names on it.
That's my first prep coach.
Dan got Hazlitt. Did you have your actual name on your plan or was it someone else's?
I did, but when I got to Miami Pro, because I had aspirations of becoming a Miami Pro.
Double Pro.
Pro. There were three other guys in my category and at least three the weight category below me. And we all had exactly the same training plans, nutrition plans, and at various different points he'd forgotten which person was doing what. But okay. A lot of these guys were like 20 kilos lighter than me, which explains why I felt like utter shit, frankly. Yeah,
it's like you were either like under, like depleted, or they sort of exceeded the carb load a little bit too much based on if everyone's on the same sort of peak week.
Yeah.
So yeah, Luke has it. And do we, ESG, maybe Dan will remember as well. I don't think Dr. Mike will. The strength guys?
No, I don't think I do.
So they were the only sort of two, the strength guys, Jason Tremblay. Do you know Jeff Nippard? Do you know Jeff Nippard?
Yeah.
So Jeff was originally, came on board as the strength guys coach or presenter, whatever it was. And they had really good spreadsheets. Because I remember back in the day, it was all about, oh, look at your spreadsheets. Oh, it does this sum and it works out the average load of when you last had a number two in the toilet and that. And
I never had a spreadsheet, I've got to say.
No.
Interestingly, just the thing about Mr. Hazlett, do you know where he got his plan from? No. Mike's looking so uncomfortable because we're mentioning names now.
I don't know who this is. So
okay, we won't mention names anymore. But he actually, he was coached by Mr. PG, we don't need to say the full name, but he's friend to the podcast anyway. And because I sat next to him in my postgrad nutrition and I showed him what I was given, he was like, yeah, that's what I gave him.
Yeah.
So it was literally a case of monkey seeing.
But at least you know it's come from a decent place.
Yeah.
You're going to copy someone, at least it'd be someone that's decent, not.
Yeah, just followed by 100 other people. Yeah.
To play devil's advocate here, mm-hmm. and I'm certainly not recommending giving like completely generic plans to everyone, but it probably does also show that the basics work, right? Like I get that it's completely misleading to be like, this is a personalized plan to you and then just give everyone the same workouts. But realistically, if most of his clients are prep clients and he's giving everyone the same programming, take the nutrition out of it.
But to play devil's advocate in return, I would say, like, Dan's experience with competition, I think that you've been very vocal and open about it being quite negative and being difficult from a relationship with food perspective. And perhaps if you had been coached with like a reasonable nutrition plan that wasn't targeted towards people 20 kilos lighter than you.
Nutrition aside.
Yeah.
Oh, you mean just the training, you mean?
Yeah.
Yeah, and I think that's really interesting.
GVT pretty much.
Yeah, so, the training, actually the basics are the basics because they work and people will get incredible results.
I agree with that.
Very similar training programs, unless maybe they're injured and they need some adaptations.
Yeah, I mean, that's one thing. It's like, if you have a very specific target market, you can have a very specific system. So you don't have to, so your onboarding, your education side of things can be used multiple times. Like I'll say time and time again that online coaching, not COVID coaching on doing star jumps. I remember when people 2012, there was no software. There probably was Dropbox and stuff like that. But I literally had my client's stuff on a USB stick. And I'd send it through to them and I'd email it through to them. Like that was where it started in 2012. There was no software.
I remember you told me about that USB stick.
Yeah. And it got lost in my Vauxhall Corsa handbrake because it decided to have like a plastic covering with a substantial gap that a USB could fall down. And I just remember going, oh my God, I've lost everything. Because that was my thing with online coaching, is having the data, because you end up, you have to, the beautiful thing about in-person personal training is you can have conversations, you can see things. Without that, you're just looking at data. So if you don't have your data, it's really hard to make decisions, because there was none of this back in the day. We're like, I'm going to do a weekly call with all of my clients and then I'm going to do Loom videos. Again, I'm not against that stuff, but there does need to be a price. When you look at business, you've got to say, well, how many for this service, how many hours of fulfillment is that going to take me per month to then warrant the price that I'm going to be charging? So like ESG said, when I first started doing online coaching, I would write everything from scratch. It would take me like 6 to 8 hours to do like their little startup Word document, their spreadsheet. I'd have sort of a template, but I would do everything from scratch. And at the end of the day, if you've got a very specific target market, especially from the training side of things, it would just be build bloody templates and then tweak it based on what equipment they have available. Maybe if they can't squat for shit, or they can go ass to grass. And then the only thing you're really changing is exercise selection and maybe some sets and reps based on where they currently are in their fitness journey. So there doesn't need to be a lot of custom. I feel like personalization, not custom. Custom, I'd say, is something where you're starting from scratch. It would just be like, no, like your training principles are probably like specificity, progressive overload, they're not going to change. Like progression schemes are not really going to change. So why do stuff from scratch over and over again? Why not have an upper lower split, 3 or 4 versions of that? Maybe have a whole body 3 times per week. Maybe have a push pull legs. And then all you're doing is you're tweaking rather than creating stuff from scratch. And that's just, I think people be like, oh, that's lazy. And I'll be like, lazy is another word for being efficient. So as long as it's personalized to that individual and you're gathering that data, you don't get any brownie points for making it harder than it actually needs to be. The main thing is,
yeah, it's almost just like, what are you doing? Why? If you have 2 people that come to you with the same goal and no physical constraints, like what builds muscle for one person will build it for another person. There might be some tweaks as to how many times a week they can train, but if they have the same constraints, then yeah, they should get the same program. Like, what, trying to make a program different for the sake of it being different will probably result in a worse program.
Yeah. And I guess, coming back to that point about the show prep side of things, it depends on, and I know we've had this chat before, I'm always at ease if both parties know exactly what they're getting. So if you've gone to a coach for something bespoke, they're charging a certain amount for something very individualized for you, and then you find out they've given the same to 100 other people, that's not. Whereas if they're got a slightly lower barrier to entry and they're on a group trading program, for example, with many other people, then that kind of is an expectation.
I'm just looking at my first ever online plan, which it turns out I bought in November 2011.
From who? And
yeah, that's what I was thinking. Who?
So it was called On Point Personal Training. And my plan, so my first day for this is, so I've never been in a gym before. Incline chest press, flat dumbbell flies, cable crossover,
chest
push-ups, both decline, flat and incline, bent over row, dumbbell single arm row, lat pull down and chin-ups.
Yeah, so not that much volume for someone that's never been in a gym.
Why would you not stick body weight chin-ups for someone that's never been in the gym at the end of their workout?
Can you remember the day after or 2 days after?
I never did it. I bought it and I never looked at it again. I looked at it. I was like, what on earth are skull crushers? Yeah. I can't do this.
Sounds dangerous.
I never looked at it again.
Yeah. I remember sending out Word documents it must have been like 2012 probably as well. It would just be a little Word document with exercises on them.
I never
on a hard drive somewhere.
I never did that. It was even Word doc. It would never be Word docs. It would be, I'd save as PDF.
This was a PDF. Can I also say that it was
faster than me?
It was three workouts and I had to do each of them twice a week. So it was training 6 days on, 1 day off. So nice. Never been to the gym before, but start going now and go 6 times a week.
That's basically what everyone does off the back of Christmas. Have 2 months on the run up to Christmas off, and then I'm going to slash my calories in half. I'm not going to eat any confectionery, stop drinking alcohol, and I'm going to train twice a day for 6 days a week.
And the train would always be on a spreadsheet to track the data.
I didn't get that. I obviously didn't get the premium package.
No, but that's the thing as well. It's like, what, when I first started, I feel like you micro coach and you try and change stuff. But when I first started, it was like each week I'm going, I'm going to change this, I'm going to change that, I'm going to change this exercise, I'm going to change that. And you're like, actually, just stick to the plan. Like, you shouldn't really. And over years of coaching, I'd always, if there was like a plateau for whatever reason, it's being able to coach a client and know that a plateau is a good thing, because it just shows you that you've actually progressed and you now need to adjust the stimulus. And I feel like in the end, if they were due a new training program, I wouldn't really mess with their nutrition if that week they would get a new training stimulus. And 9 times out of 10, it would do the job and I wouldn't even have to touch the nutrition. So again, that's just something from getting repetitions. Like, you could tell me that and I could go back to Dropbox or G Drive and I could tell you Josh Waite's macros that he was on this day, like 5 years ago, 6, 7, 8 years ago. Because I had that data.
Yeah, I think something I find with coaches, especially the good ones, is they obviously try and over-deliver and they try and give as much value as possible, which means that you often end up changing things that don't need to be changed because you lack confidence in saying nothing needs to be changed this week. Because you almost think, well, they won't value me if I've not changed something, like I should make a tweak. Like, and it used to be with when it was all, if it fits your macros, it'd be like, oh yeah, increase your fats by 2 grams and drop your carbs by a couple of grams. Like, that's the change that we need this week. Like, you're just making change for absolutely no point, and it makes it so much harder to stick to. And that's confidence as a coach to be like, no, you just need more time on this. You don't need to change anything. It's consistency that we're looking for.
Yeah, that's definitely confidence and experience thing. Because, you know, to the same level that I think in-person personal trainers is, get used to charging time for money. So if someone's paid an hour, you know, if you have a really effective, intense workout with people, it takes you a few years to kind of do a session with your client and get to the end of your session. If they want to chat about certain things at the end of that, that's fine. But you're not just going to fill that hour with exercise and extra sets and extra volume if they don't need to. But initially, that fluff, that expectation when you first start training people, you're like, well, someone's paid an hour for my time. I have to fill every second of that with every possible movement.
Mm. One thing I hate about online coaches is when they say you get 24/7 support. I'm like, really? I'm like, you can message me whenever you want, but you ain't getting that. One of the things that I learned from Dr. Eric Helm, sorry, I know we shouldn't mention another doctor, well, I'm on a call with one doctor. He was, when he came over to do his seminar, we was in ZZ's, I think, and
classy.
Do you know what I mean? The cheesy garlic bread with the garlic bread nothing with balsamic. What is it? Balsamic vinegar?
Yeah, balsamic onions. Nothing beats it.
But Mike, it's not the same now, mate. It's not the same. Yeah, they've it's like anything good, isn't it? They start off with a 7 out of 7, and then they start dropping to sixes. And I know you can't do a point, but it's probably between a 5 and a 6 now. They've changed it. It's not the same. And I remember being on my phone and Eric's like, oh, what are you doing, Luke? So I'm just replying to my client. He's like, it's 9 o'clock at night. What the hell are you doing? And so then I found out from him, he's like, no, just as long as you say, I will respond 11 a.m. to 12 noon every single day. You will get a response within 24 hours. So setting that clear expectations, what I see personal trainers time and time again is they try and bend over backwards and they're like, oh, you cancel a session? Can you do it at 9 o'clock on a Saturday? You're like, oh, yeah, I will do that. I'm like, everything you do in your business is down to you. And you need to control the variables. And I feel like by giving them too much, you're not helping them in the long term because they're not learning and they're not taking that. You're not really helping with, what is it?
Motivation.
Yeah, no, what is it? Self-efficacy.
Mm.
Autonomy, yeah.
Like making decisions prior to that and knowing that, look, if you do go out, it's not the end of the world. And that's why I feel like online coaching, I'll give you an example of Debbie and Josh. Josh is 23 years of age, finished university. My Fitness Pal is his best friend. He loves to train. He's been training. I was skinny and now I'm putting on muscle mass. Josh was amazing to train, motivated, didn't need the accountability. It pretty much was more of like a here's your program. Perfect. You're hitting everything. Don't need to change anything. Cool. We want to drop a bit more weight, dropped your macros, etc. Boom. Debbie was his mum. Debbie had been on every single yo-yo diet and was an absolute nightmare to coach online. And when people say, well, in person, like, we'll die, I'm like, no, because there's still a large portion of the population that are not motivated to train, that don't care about improving their knowledge of training and nutrition, that are older and don't really want to embrace technology. And she would probably spend, I'd probably 40 minutes per month with Josh, and then probably 4 hours to 6 hours of just dealing with, oh, Luke, I'm going away on the, he weighed himself daily. She weighed herself once per week with her eyes closed and she didn't even do it. Josh had to send me her stuff through. And then for a measurement, she did it again. He had to measure like every 4 weeks and she had her eyes closed throughout. I got really good results with Debbie. But then I was like, now I need to call this business Shredded by Science, because I realized when you first start off, and I feel like this is good for even in-person personal trainers, when people say, what type of gym should I work at? I'm like, go to a gym that has members. Don't go to a private studio. And you might think you want to coach a certain type of clientele. Like my thing was, I only want to work with athletes. I don't want to work with women that are overweight who want to tone up. But then you soon realize that once you get on that gym floor, there's no faster way of becoming a better trainer than working with different types of clients, because they all propose different challenges. You know, why is it that that person cannot squat? And I'm teaching them exactly the same way as this young person that can squat really well. And I feel like the best bit to fast track your journey as a personal trainer is to coach as many people as possible. And then my in-person clients were MILFs. I loved MILFs. Those were my in-person clients, but they were the people I did not want to coach online. Those were the Joshes. So again, it's looking at marrying your service to the target market. And like ESG said earlier, the target market will make it easier to then attract those people. So you do stand out amongst a field of load of Instagram influencers. And then the actual systems and education and community are all like-minded as well. So therefore that helps with client retention, and you don't have to keep changing the way you coach people. And it's easier to price a service because Debbie should have paid me four times the amount that Josh paid me based on the amount of time I spent coaching her per month. And she only lasted probably 8 to maybe 16 weeks. And Josh stayed with me for like 2.5 years.
Mm. I think that's a fairly young industry though. There was never, to a certain degree, a lot of people are still winging it now. There was none of this guidance at the time. Like, it was all just finding our own way. And I do think people are in a hurry to be a specialist these days before even becoming a generalist. You know, they want to do their qualifications and become a body transformation specialist or whatever it may be. But then I think that's also why a lot of people in the industry get a bit of a bad rep for not having a whole lot of empathy. It's because they've never had that wealth of experience of working with lots of different people and learning about the challenges that other people face. Because I think when I did PT, I was also doing a lot of shadowing work for S&C because I had aspirations of working with professional athletes. So you'd go from working with these super compliant, adherent, like literally a typo on their exercise program athletes. They would just do it. You know, if there was 100 burpees or 1,000 burpees on there, for example, random example, they would stay there till it was done. And then you'd go back to doing your personal training and like, you're just like, why can't these people just do it? So it was a baptism into learning how to get on with people as well. The communication skills, which I think aren't really taught.
I think as well, you like, how can you know what you want your niche to be? You only have this vague idea. You know, it's like when you finish school and you're like, yeah, I think I want to be a lawyer. And it's like, you have no idea what actually being a lawyer is like. You might be like, I think I want to train athletes. Like, I thought I wanted to train athletes. And then I went and did an S&C internship and I was like, this is so boring. It's exactly the same thing. Sorry to anyone that does S&C. I'm sure for you it's very interesting. And I'm sure you find what I do extremely boring. So it's not like a judgment, but for me it was. I was like, it's the same programming again and again and again. And I actually really like the challenge of the mental barriers that a lot of people face. And maybe, you know, they don't have the perfect diet or the perfect nutrition. And it's more about figuring out like life balance and life harmony for them. But to touch on your point, Luke, about the 24-hour access, like that is something that completely grates me as well. I think from both sides, it's really poor to offer that because from a client perspective, it's you're essentially saying to them, my time is worth nothing and I will give you all of it at any point and you don't need to respect my time in the slightest. I am here all of the time for you. That's not good on either side. Like you need boundaries and you need respect and you need like, this is why you'll have clients who don't check in because you've not set them clear boundaries. It's not, this is your check-in slot for the week. You owe me to check in during this time because my time is valuable too. And I'm giving it to you. Yeah. You're paying for it, but that's your slot. And I think it's even more important online to do that because you don't have the clear boundaries of you've paid for your PT session 6 till 7 PM. If you're offering this, like, just contact me whenever you want. Like, it's too vague. People like structure and they'll get better results for structure and you will have far more respect from people with, like, pushing a little bit of structure and forcing some respect from both sides.
Yeah. You wouldn't expect it from another profession, would you? Say, like, oh, a mechanic be like, I'm just going to message you when I want, when something's gone wrong with my car. Or a hairdresser and be like, yeah, I need to get my hair done again today. Can I message you at, like, 10:30 PM at night and be like, are you free tomorrow? Can you drop everything? So it's just going back to it.
Hey, so I'm on the toilet. I'm just wondering, is this normal? At any point.
But this is the way that it is really interesting because obviously we experience this kind of dichotomy quite a lot in the NHS because I think that the world has moved towards this idea that you should be able to do everything that you want to do 24 hours a day. So we've got 24-hour supermarkets, like you can go and buy stuff anytime. You can do your banking at any time. Like even the banks have 24-hour helplines. You can, whenever it takes your fancy to do something, you can do it, which means that you don't really have to plan or think about things. And it's really interesting, like what I've seen change in, you know, in the way that what people expect from the NHS, for example, like in the last few years, like the level at which they expect stuff to be done within a certain time period. And what's also interesting is the difficulty that I think people have in organizing things. Like you might have a big notice everywhere saying that, you know, repeat prescriptions need to be submitted a week in advance. But how many times do we get, oh, this needs to be done today because I've run out of medication, which of course it normal, like that's completely normal, it happens to people. But I think that part of that is perpetuated by this like 24-hour lifestyle that we seem to have fostered, 24-hour a day lifestyle, I should say. And I think that people have this expectation, like, you know, and once people know they can contact somebody on WhatsApp, they don't think, oh, well, I won't get a reply till tomorrow. They just think, oh, I'll send it now because that's when I've thought about it. Not, I shouldn't bother them. They might be having dinner. Oh, their phone will be on silent if they don't want to answer it. They can answer it tomorrow.
I agree with this, but I actually think, and surprisingly, boundaries work so well, especially.
I completely agree. And I think they need to happen.
Like, people like it. And I think once people get used to it, like I've even seen my own clients reply to stuff. Like someone might be like, oh, I sent Emma an email, but I haven't heard back. And someone will be like, she only opens emails at 2 p.m. So instead of being like, and not even like, I don't even like the 24-hour period, like I'll get back to you within 24-hour period. It's like, this is the time that I open emails. And a lot of people have now, and I would recommend this if you have that kind of structure of an email response sometimes, or even in the onboarding process of, I check my emails from clients between these 2 hours. Like that's when you'll hear from me. You won't hear a response outside of that time. Then people know what to expect. And I think it's more the unknown. Like once people have an expectation, they're normally more than happy with it. Even if you're like, cool, I've got your information to write your program, it will take me exactly X days to write it. They want that expectation rather than just, it will appear at some point in the future. And it doesn't almost matter if it's within 3 hours or if it's within 3 days. It's just, you want the expectation. You want to know what you're going to get and when.
Well, when we look at how do we get sort of health and fitness related goals and we achieve them, it's structure, it's routine, and it's consistency. So if we have that within our business, as in this is the structure, this is the routine, and I will consist. And then this is the other thing. When you set these boundaries up, you as the personal trainer have to adhere to them. You have to be consistent. So again, if you say, this is the structure, this is what you get, this is the routine. I check my emails at Monday to Friday, 2 p.m. to 3 p.m. But then if you reply on a Saturday, then you're an idiot. Because then you are not being consistent with your own boundaries and expectations. So therefore, if you're going to break them, then you're inviting everyone else to break those boundaries as well. So if we want to lose weight, then we need a probably structured routine and we need to be consistent with it time and time again. So we just need to replicate that with our business as well.
It's lead by example, isn't it?
Just a little tip for anyone, because I try and stick to these boundaries in certain areas, and the likelihood is there might be a Saturday afternoon where you're like, I shouldn't technically be working, but I have spare time and I want to reply to all these emails. Now you can just schedule everything, so reply to them all and have them scheduled for 9 a.m on Monday morning, so you're not like pushing past that boundary of, if your check-in is late, you won't get a reply until Monday morning or whatever it is.
Can we hear about your Dorian, that now that I've explained that analogy, your Dorian years, Luke, where you dipped off the radar because you were building an empire? Because when did you actually stop online coaching?
So it was started, Jamie told me she was pregnant 2012. So I was like, oh crap, via WhatsApp, by the way.
A classic.
I was just like, it wasn't even a voice. I'll have to try and like go.
I don't think you could voice note back then, could you?
No, I don't think it was. It was just more of like a text. And I'm like, I don't know what I was doing. I think I was definitely probably like just chilling, watching something, and then be like, did I just read that correctly? Straight on the phone. I think she was in the bath at the time. It was like one of those, like, I'll just text it and then leave my phone on the bed and then I'll worry about it when I get back after the bath. And I'm like, yeah, you just take your time. You get a nice bath, put some candles on, put some nice food in, and then yeah, just drop me that bomb. So 2012, then in 2013, I think August 2013, I started Shredded by Science. So I had like a year and a half of just taking on online coaching clients, and it was body transformation, 8 weeks. And then it was 10 people, and seven of them were old school friends that are never friends. They're just old school friends that signed up to it. And then I took on another coach. And I was like, after that point, I had sort of a year and a half experience of online coaching and knew. And then I started getting into, oh, actually, now I've made, I ended up saving £16,000 to £17,000 from that coaching, as well as my lecturing job at the time. And then that's when I reached out to sort of Alan Aragon, Brad Schoenfeld, Eric Helms. It's like, hey, fitness education's pretty shit in the UK. You're pretty sciencey and stuff like that. And I think that's when I subscribed to like Alan Aragon's research review and got him to emailed him. He ghosted me. I emailed him a week after. He then replied. And then I was like, I was like fanboying at the time. And I was like, wow, this is, I'm checking emails at like 5:30 in the morning. I'm going to like Jamie, the girlfriend. I'm like, Alan's just emailed me back. I'm like getting really excited. So then I'm like, okay, now I've got to put on a fitness event. But then what I did then was I looked at the research papers and I looked at the other people that he did research with, and it was Brad Schoenfeld. And then I saw one with like Dr. Eric Helms. So then it was like, I'm the guy that managed to get Alan Aragon to come over to the UK. Do you want to come over to the UK too? Then Brad would speak to Alan. Who's this Luke Johnson guy? Like, no one knows who the hell this. I basically influenced marketed without even knowing. He didn't even have a term at the time. And then once I had Brad, I then reached out to Eric Helms. Like, Eric Helms, I'm the guy that's managed to get Brad Schoenfeld and Alan Aragon to come over to the UK. Do you want to come over to the UK? So I had Alan like October 2013. I had Brad Schoenfeld January 2014. Then I had Eric Helms April 2014. And at the time, no one was really, I don't think anyone was putting on any events for people like that, science-based people at that scale, like flying people over from the States to come over to put a conference. So I ended up making, at the time, it was myself, Danny Grooch, and Joe Agu. And I was like, actually, I've done pretty much most of the work here, so why should it be a revenue split? So that anything after the first one wasn't that. It was just a solo gig. We made £28,000 in a weekend. And I was like, oh, that's pretty much my salary. So that was pretty good. And then at that point, I was like, when I had to put on fitness events, I stopped reading. I probably was still reading research papers and stuff like that. But then I started going, I need to change my skill set. I need to start learning about marketing. And like with most things, you have like the bro scientist and the scientist. And in marketing, you have the bro marketers like, hey, this is normally $997, but for like 10 seconds, it's 97p. And you're like, oh, you sign up to it. So then all of my time, I'm very obsessive with, if I need to learn something, I will, if I didn't have kids, me, I wouldn't, I'll just be on it the whole time. Like I remember like one Christmas day, I'm like, right, we're going to do YouTube this year. And I'd spend like Christmas day just watching videos on like YouTube and stuff like that. So then that's when I launched Shredded by Science. So we went from myself, Danny Grooch, and Ali, three coaches, to 12 coaches. And we did that from 2013 up to 2015. Because then what I realized, and we, at that time we did one-to-one online coaching. We started, we took Juliana on to do female group online coaching. We then tried that with men. Didn't really work with men because they, guess what? They don't give a fuck about each other and they don't care about community. Just like, all I care about is myself. And I don't want to be in a Facebook group with a load of other men just going, hey, like they just don't want to do it. So that's when all the things that I do now is just from mistakes that I've made of trying stuff. So we did that. We had a membership.
Interesting though, just to like interrupt here, and this is such an interesting story, but like Jamie Alderton's male group coaching did phenomenally well and they fucking loved it. Like they lapped it up, and that's such a strong bond and strong group. And what I will say is, when you were describing Debbie, I'm like, that's every single one of my EC Method clients. Well, I mean, like, not exactly. And I'm sorry, if any are listening, I'm not saying that like all of the attributes, but
she loves you really.
But like very similar, right? A lot of them need a lot of support, a lot of reassurance, a lot of the things that you'd think wouldn't be perfect for online coaching, but actually that business does extremely well. So I don't know, I guess what I'm saying is, you can, depending on the service that you're offering, you can mold that service to the group or the individual that you're looking to serve. And I think, I guess with things now are maybe slightly different, and maybe there wasn't as many like I imagine Debbie would have done very well in a group, because part of the reassurance that you were constantly giving her one-to-one, she would have got from her peer group.
Yeah. They need education. That's why I say like that target market worked well with groups, because it's not a personalized, it's not a plan that's specific. The price isn't the same. Because I say Debbie sees her health and fitness, and everyone has prices dependent on what you value in life. Like, if you really like food and you want to spend a lot of your money on food, you'll do that. If you couldn't care less, you wouldn't spend that much money. So with that target market, not only do they have probably all these being grown, like as a female with everything that they see, and just maybe from their parents of like always dieting and this slimming world and this and that, and all of these yo-yo diets that they go on, and celebs that they see time and time again, like their upbringing is going to be different to Josh's. Like, here it was a different generation, and the stuff that Debbie went through and has tried, it is a lot different to what Josh had. So going to the group thing, groups work extremely well for that target market because the price point's lower and it's not a bespoke plan, but the whole thing of the community, but more importantly, it's an education at the same time. You have to re-educate that target market when it comes to nutrition, when it comes to training. Like, when I first started training clients, women thought lifting weights would make them bulky. Like, they honestly believe that. And that's one beautiful thing about all these Instagram influencers who are lifting heavy ass weights, doing hip thrusts. It demonstrates that, oh, actually, I look at you and you have a really nice, they don't say physique, their body. And now I'm not. So think about like 2011, 10 and stuff like that. That was a really key thing. Like, no, women can't lose, like lift weight. So you've got, there isn't evolution of that. So that's a really good thing. But with Jamie's group thing, so that was probably later on. But I think the reason why it would work then is it's a challenge, and wasn't there prizes? So if you look at a male perspective, it's more of like, it's a challenge. I want to beat you. I want to be the best transformation. I want to get that result. So again, I wouldn't consider that a group coaching program as such. I would consider that more of like a group challenge. So again, it's appealing to different target markets and going, I'm going to bust a gut to get the best transformation so I can win an iPad or whatever it would be. So again, you could classify them from an outsider's and very just looking at a snapshot. They're both groups. This worked, that didn't work. But the deliverables and the words that you use are going to be different. This is a challenge. This isn't. And so, in 2015, I then realized that actually I've got that business model is not going to, that doesn't make me money. It makes the coaches money because there's only a certain percentage that you can have. And I feel like Danny Grooch, when I first started, was on 75%. Then I took Ali on, I was like, okay, you're on 70%. And then when I took the other coaches on, it was a percentage split based on the number of clients that they had. Because what we found is most of them were either personal trainers that did another job. And one of our things was you had to post once per week as on Facebook. But then there's nothing stopping them from not doing that. So it's fine when they don't have the clients, but when they hit client capacity, it's like, where's the motivation to carry on putting out the market and efforts? So in 2015 is when we pivoted. I sort of go around, just like going around in mini circles. It was sort of like, hey, you was a fitness instructor, personal trainer. You wasn't very good, a gym floor personal trainer, Luke. So you decided, and you didn't like being dictated to. Now I know what I know. When you first start off and you don't know that, you're like, I have to train you before you work, during your lunch break, and after you finish work. Like, I am your bitch at your beck and call. That's how it was, because when you're starting off and you have to pay rent, if someone says to you, I want to train at 4:30 in the morning, you're like, I really do not want to train you at 4:30 in the morning, but I need the money. I need to do that. And I feel like trainers that are gym floor trainers that have experienced that are far more resilient than these little pansies right now that get really, I can only work 4 hour a week or this and that. Like, it makes your resilience of working long, hard days feel easy because you remember the days of being on the gym floor, starting really early, finishing really late. Like, you have to, I guarantee that there's probably not many professions outside personal trainers that would have as high of a divorce rate. Because when you go out, you're on your phone, be like, who are you talking to? Another woman? It's like, yes, my client, she's just gone out and she's had too many pina coladas and she's losing her shit.
I wouldn't know how much gym floor rent is these days for commercial gyms.
Mine was £400 it was back in the day at Bannatyne's gym, Grove Park.
My first private gym I worked at was £800. Wow. And that was at the time. So I had my personal training I say business, it was a job, but it was a job really, because I was working for my university gym. But when we relocated back to Essex and I needed to get a job to pay the mortgage, I was working school hours, I was working for a school, and I was PTing on top of that.
Yeah.
So as you can imagine, like having to pay 800 quid a month rent.
Yes.
I was working all hours.
Yeah, but I think like you were saying, Luke, I think it gives you work ethic. And it's something that I've realized more and more recently, because I think especially working online, and we're all self-employed, and you don't really totally see what other people are doing. The difference in work ethic and work output between people is ridiculous. Like for one person, they think that like one day's work that I might produce is more than what they would do in a whole week. And I'm like, how can you be so unbelievably unproductive? But there's just a completely different level of like, I think it's partly the expectations that you put on yourself.
There is a glitz and glamour to this industry.
Like, it's very hard to see that. You're like, I work hard in comparison to what I think hard work is. And I think that's one of the benefits of doing like group mentoring, or like being more in touch with like some of your peer group, is seeing actually how much work goes in behind that. Because it might just look like so-and-so turns up on a live now and again, but you actually don't see all the behind the scenes work and what they're doing in other areas, and all the effort that goes into it and all the time that goes into it. And I think that it can look like online coaching is very, very easy, or you can look at people who have probably spent years and years and years of their life working 40 hours at least in the gym floor, and then building up this online business and working way more hours than you could imagine. And now they're like, yeah, guys, I only work 4 hours a week or whatever. It's like, yeah, you can work that little because you've outsourced everything now, because you've built it, but you didn't work that little when you were building it. And I think it sets these totally unrealistic expectations, and it's sort of become cool to work 4 hours a week. And I'm like, I actually like coaching. Like, I don't want to work 4 hours a week. As soon as I get businesses to the point that they're only taking up 4 hours a week, I start another one. Like, I don't know. I think it's the difference between when people genuinely love what they do and they don't really want to outsource it all. They don't want to have only 4 hours of work a week.
Do you think that is it? It's the common misconception, because there is a glitz and glamour attached to working in the fitness industry. Is that this perception that you can jump straight online, and that the old thought that build it and they shall come, like as in, oh, I'm qualified now, people are just going to throw themselves at me? But actually it's a totally different world, because you not only have to be really super proficient at your job, but you also have to have an interest and have some understanding of marketing, you know, your finances to a certain degree. These are all the things that I had no idea about when I started. Social media marketing, like all of these things you now have to find time for. I don't think people realize how much is involved.
Yeah, I feel like nowadays with social media and a lot of business mentors and stuff like that, you have resources where you can get quicker results. But then what happens is a lot of them just focus on that acquisition side of things. And it's all about click funnels, this Facebook ads, that this free challenge, this, doing that. And you can get, like, you can acquire clients, but then it's the fulfillment side of things as well. It's like, it's a double-edged sword. If you say, I am the best trainer, I'm the best nutritionist, but you don't actually, you're like anti-marketing and selling, it's like, well, no one knows that you're the best nutritionist. No one knows that you're the best trainer or the programmer. It's a double-edged sword. It's like, which one do I need? And it's like, well, you need both. But then I feel like a lot of people come into, there's far better industries and professions if you want to make a shit ton of money than there is being a personal trainer. So I feel like most people become personal trainers, or when we became personal trainers, because you wanted to help people. You probably didn't get into being a personal trainer going, I want to make 250, like 500 grand a year. But I feel like now with the way the industry's going, is people getting into it with these expectations that they can get really quick results. And like, no, you can get quick clients if you're willing to use these tactics or spend some money. And I feel like a lot of people are getting into this game now, and they're spending far too much time on the marketing side of things and not enough time on the actual being a good coach. Mm-hmm. And being a good coach and providing a good service means that you don't have to become the next marketing guru, the Gary V person, because like actually for this business model and what I'm doing, I only need to have 40 to 50 clients and I'm able to live the life that I want to live. I feel like a lot of people look at screenshots and things that go up and go, I expect it to be easy. So when it's not easy, and let's be honest as well, sometimes you're just not very good people. Like you just don't have any personality. So if you want to be the next James Smith, but you're like boring as fuck, you're not going to be very successful. So again, it's looking at picking your own route, looking at your own skill set, looking at your own cards and going, okay, what do I have to play here? What do I need to get better at? And is it, there's always going to be room for the best of the best in the industry, but I feel like people are coming into this game now and expecting quick and easy results. When, as ESG said before, people just see the tip of the iceberg. They don't see all the years prior to that. And I suppose going back to your question, Dan, is like, I feel like I've got a fairly decent personality. Like if I wanted to build a personal brand, I feel like I could do it. But my thing was, I didn't want my business to be predicated on me being front and center the whole time. I wanted my business to succeed because it was a good business. I didn't want it to succeed because I had the gift of the gab and I could out-market people. So that's why, even like now, I'm putting myself out there more, mainly because I feel like it's easier to just build a personal brand nowadays than it would be to build like a Shredded by Science or thingy, because we say people buy into people. And there are some big companies out there which have, you wouldn't know who the CEOs are, but from a personal trainer fitness industry, it's a lot easier to build a connection with an individual than it is a company brand. So that's where I'm sort of going, actually, I want to build my personal brand a little bit. But then the other thing as well, when I'm dead, I want my kids and my grandkids to be like, oh, that's what my great granddad was like. He was all right, or he's a bit of a dickhead. I don't really care. So again, I feel like if your business is predicated
to this podcast.
Yeah, exactly. If your business is predicated on you being in shape and always present, then you're always running yourself at a risk. And I feel like one of the things I learned from Paul Moore is the reason why I started Shredded by Science was a lot of people they feel like they have a business, but they don't. They're self-employed. So unless they turn up to the gym, or unless they continue to do their weekly check-ins, then it's like, no, you don't have a business. Because if something bad happens to you, then your business is fucked. You ain't making money. So for me, it was listening to Paul Moore when he said he's driving once and he got into a car accident. And that was him. He's put out. And I think I was on a podcast the other day, and it was like, would you be where you are today? Like, or would you still be a college lecturer? And I've always said from a young age, I am nothing special whatsoever. But I've always said I'm very competitive. So from a young age, it was always, I've not been put on this earth with being content, with just being average and just living life. So for me, it was looking at when I found out I was going to be a dad, I needed to make a change. I would have still made that change. It would have just maybe happened 5-6 years later. But because it was, oh crap, this baby wasn't planned, I need to actually do something. My thing was, I need to build a business that I would literally say, if I lost my legs or my arms, but I had some way of still having my brain, some way or some form of communication to be able to communicate to a team within the company, then my family are okay. So that was my motivation of why I didn't want to be front and center. That was one of the things where I'm like, I don't want to have my business predicated on me being front and center. I want my business to be set up so if something bad happens to me, my family is still looked after.
And you change that.
I was going to ask you that actually, because I think most people who found out about like a surprise pregnancy would be like, right, better sign this contract at the college to make sure I'm on 20 grand a year for the rest of my life. Like, and they'd be like, well, that's the sensible thing to do. That's what I know is reliable. That's my source of income. So I think it shows like a lot that you were like, no, do you know what? Like, I want to take ownership, because that's effectively what you've done. Instead of being like, here's something that's going to be pretty secure and I'll have a pension and whatever, I'll have enough, to I'm going to own this so that, yeah, it might seem riskier, but actually my effort will be the output, essentially. Like, I can make this as big as I want to make it.
Yeah, because my parents were like, oh, you're in education. I've got 2 degrees, you know. I was in education. It's like, there's no more secure job than education. Everyone's going to need a teacher. I'm like, all right, cool. But I'm like, where my original plan was to go part-time. And then once the conference went as well as it did, I was like, I'm going all in. Because I've got plenty of weaknesses. But my thing is like, what is the worst that could happen? And if I can live with the worst that can happen, I'm just going to do it. Because I don't care. So I'm like, I can face what the worst is. And the hardest thing is when you do have family, when you do have kids, you can't be as bullish. Because the worst that can happen is not just me going to live with mummy and daddy. It's going, what is the worst thing that can happen to me and my children and my partner? And if that's still like, I can live with that, and you have the support of your partner that they don't care if you are successful or not. It's like, if you can live with that, then I'm like, I'm going to do it. So that's probably one of my biggest strengths is that mindset. But then
and one of the things- belief by the sounds of it.
Yeah, is it? It's not even self-belief. I will find a way for it to work. And I've never been shy of going, this ain't working, or it might be working, but this is not where I want the business to go in. I don't mind changing shit up.
Because it's similar to the frame of like regret minimization, where you're like, what would I regret more?
Yeah.
Like this failing or not trying at all. And for you, maybe in that position, you're like, actually, what I would regret more is staying as a lecturer for the rest of my life and not feeling fulfilled than even if I tried this business thing, but it didn't work out. Like even if it failed, that means I'd go back to lecturing, right? Worst case scenario, I'd crawl back with my tail between my legs and I'd ask for my job back.
But yeah,
that's the kind of choices that you've got to make. And I think actually looking at that worst case scenario often is quite motivating because you're like, yeah, I'd make it work. Or I'd just try something else. Like one thing fails isn't the end of the road. It's just, I need to figure out a different way to make this work.
My thing's, but I feel being competitive and having a commitment going, if it's not working now, it doesn't mean it's not going to work. But then sometimes the best thing to do is kill something off that isn't working. So it's being aware enough and going, actually, this isn't working. So like sticking to something, if it's not going to work, again, it is worse than going, okay, this isn't working. So you want to try, like if you just, oh, it ain't working, I'm switched to the next thing, that doesn't work, then probably there's a problem with you, not the thing that you're trying to pursue. And going back to the regret thing, I feel like regret always wins. It's just, do you let the regret, I will regret this today if I don't pursue this, or I will look back on when I'm 85 and on my deathbed, you will always regret. No one has a deathbed thing and go, oh, I'm really glad I didn't do that thing. It's always going to be, I regret that.
I had an amazing rig though, and I had thousands of followers on Instagram.
There's loads of research around regret of like, people regret the things they didn't do twice as much as the things that they did do, even if they didn't work out.
Yeah, like I suppose, I don't think like, if you try something, I don't think you regret you tried it. It would be maybe I shouldn't have done that. But yeah, I feel like regret is quite a strong word. And most people, you see it all the time. It's like, hey, I went to a care home and we asked all the people and they said, what one thing, advice would you give someone younger? And it'd be like, don't do, if you want to pursue something, don't like pursue it. And if it doesn't work out, it doesn't work out. At least you know, rather than that. And even to this day, like business, people see like the outside of business, but I'm like things, and you don't see all the bad stuff that goes on. You don't see like once my business is nowhere near where I wanted it to be. But then that's because I always feel, even though my company was registered in 2013, we only recently started PT coaching. It feels like my business has only just started like 2 to 3 months ago. And then before that, it was 2 years ago when we rebranded. And then before that, it was before when we was doing online coaching. So for me, if you look at my business as in when it was formed 2013, I have moments all the time. I think, why am I doing this? Because I still don't know why. And I don't think anyone really knows why. The reason why you think it's the why probably isn't. It's probably something you've heard and that's why you think it's the why. But you could quite easily just, so for me, I suppose going back to the regret thing, I know that if I don't try, when I'm 80, if I even make it to 80, I know I will regret it because of me as an individual. And when I succeed, because I ain't succeeded yet, I will tell everyone the shit that I've had to deal with since 2013. And it ain't personal. Yeah, it isn't like, oh, hardship and family and stuff like that. I'm talking about business-wise, stuff that I can't say until I get to that point. So that's my thing as well, is going, you might see the outsiders and the snapshot of you want to see, but for me, I am nowhere near where I want to go. But then quite equally, I could quite many a times I go, just stop, Luke. Like my worst case scenario now is to kill off PTC and just have a personal brand and me, my money in my motherfucking pocket be more than what I've got right now. That's my worst case scenario. But my upside best case scenario is a lot better if I stick with this path that I'm currently on. But I will have to eat. I've eaten shit for many a years, but I don't go on social media and share that stuff. You don't see that stuff. And it's going like, yes, many a days I question myself and go, why do I do this? Why do I have this many overheads? Why don't I just be a one-man band and probably have a better life? Because I'm like, I might have a better life now, but I know on the deathbed, I'd have been, look, you could have done that. And my thing's all about testing myself. And in business, as things scale, your role has to change. Your skill set has to change. Like, it's really easy to be a good technician. It's really easy to become a good personal trainer. There's plenty of good sources out there. Like people on the podcast, you can learn a lot from people on the podcast right now. And you can become very good at a technician's role, as in a hairdresser, a personal trainer. You can find online courses for that. But then as you go up and your skill sets change, like no one tells you, how the fuck do I know how to be a CEO? How do I know how to be a manager? Yeah, there's stuff to teach you how to be a manager. But then again, there's certain things with like to get the learning and skill set, the higher up you go in business, the harder it is because there isn't YouTube videos on it. Or there is a lot of sharks that will sell a dream, but actually don't have any substance to back it up. And most of the time, people that become successful don't become successful before signing up to a course or doing this program. It's probably they found good mentors and they're mentors in a way that there's no exchange of money. And it's someone that's maybe, I feel like a mentor is just someone that's a year or two ahead of you. So wherever you are now, you just need someone that's been there. And I feel like sometimes if that mentor's been like 10, 15 years ahead of you, I feel like that might not be the best mentor because what worked 10, 15 years ago doesn't necessarily work in today's climate. I don't know what I was getting at, but there we go.
That's interesting, obviously, because I find it quite fascinating that, you know, we don't need to go into names or anything like that, but often people that are offering mentorship nowadays are, some of them are people that made their name on the gym floor 10, 15 years ago. And it's, you know, it's changed. I certainly don't profess to be a mentor in any shape or form. I'm learning. I think I've probably got a few things to share with people, but I don't, you know, offer what you guys offer.
There's a balance. Like I think that there is, I think you can, like Luke saying, is that some of the people just need to be a few steps ahead. And actually that can be really relevant. But I think that there is also a tendency to overplay people's expertise. And I think that the problem is double-sided. And the problem is CPD at the end of the day. If you're engaging in CPD and you're continuing to learn and continuing to understand and speak and communicate with the clients that you're trying to serve as a mentor. And I speak this like from my perspective as an educator in a different field. Like, you can still keep your finger on the pulse while being a bit removed from what's actually happening on the ground. But the Dunning-Kruger effect of people having done things like a little tiny bit and suddenly think that they're the world's leading expert on how to do everything is I think very disingenuous. And it's almost, I think, like in part sort of insulting to people to think that you can mentor people when you've a lot of I think people who claim to be mentors are actually becoming people who are less experienced than the people that they're mentoring. And yes, you look at the relationship and you think, what are you telling them?
I feel like a lot of, especially in, let's just go out, it is a lot of mentors or coaches in the fitness industry are failed personal trainers. And it's a lot easier to sell a financial return on investment than it is to sell someone going through hardship of going from where they currently are to getting this physique. So that's the, even like today, I'm pretty more extreme. I go, I was not a successful in-person personal trainer, but I openly put my hands up and say that. But from an online coaching perspective, I say I am pretty successful at that. But I feel like the most successful people are always the people that are always continuing to learn and they're not the ones that blow their own trumpet. They're very more reserved and they're being like, hey, look, I remember when people would be like, hey, you any good at tennis? And I'd be like, no, I'm not very good at tennis. I'd always say no. So rather than saying yes, not saying I'm good at tennis, I was fairly okay. But I feel like those which shout the most of like, look how good I am, are the ones that probably are not as good and maybe have other issues of why they need that big. They need to, they're probably the ones listening to like these tapes now. It's like, you're the best. No one's better than you. Your mummy loves you. You can see, all the affirmations. I'm like, cool. Like if I see it, that's what I suppose one of the bit is, you, I don't call myself the OG, but everyone's sort of calling me the OG at the moment. I've coached these people, have gone through the SBS Academy. They've paid me time for Skypes and stuff like that. And they're teaching their stuff. And again, it's going back to social media. You see the snapshot. And even I, after all the experience, will look at stuff and I'll be like, how the fuck have they got these people earning this much money? But you get enough people on. It's going back to the person that coached you, Dan. It was, you get 100 people following the same program. Guess what? It's going to work on 5%.
Yeah.
But there's the 95 other percent that are probably reaching out to ESG or me going, oh yeah, I've been part of this and it was terrible. I've got a few videos in a Facebook group.
It's that, you know, confusing confidence for competence thing I think we have in the health space quite often as well. But I feel like we can talk about this forever. If we can just one from everyone, if possible, what will stick around that's currently going on and what will fizzle out mentoring wise and online coaching wise? Do you think, what do you think is on trend that's going to fizzle out and what's going to stick around?
High ticket.
Which way?
Go.
What, as a phrase or?
No, I just, when people, what would you class as a definition of high ticket? It'd be good to if we're saying high ticket from a personal training perspective, what are you thinking financially wise? Like if I'm on a sales call with someone, how much money would you classify as high ticket?
I don't personally like that term at all.
No, I don't. That's what, but I'm saying if someone said to you what's high ticket, what number comes into your head? From a fitness personal trainer perspective,
it's wild now. Like it could literally be freaking anything at this point.
People are plucking random numbers out of the sky.
Yeah, I think what really gets me about that is that you're putting up barriers.
Yeah.
What you're paying, care about your health. If you're not willing to sacrifice, you know, like having a TV or a mobile phone, what, you've got an iPhone? Well, then of course you can afford personal training. What, you don't care about your health? You should be paying me $2,000 a month, blah, blah, blah. Like it's absolutely horrendous. Like what we should be doing is, as a fitness industry, is trying to get as many people involved as possible. That's not undercharging, but that's making it feasible for people so they don't have to choose between their family holiday and working with this ridiculously charged personal trainer who tends to be some of the worst trainers I've ever like come across. Like no experience. What they've done instead of invest in education, what they've done instead of do like further education and develop their skill set is pay for freaking marketing courses and then hard sell people and pushy sales on people. Like it's the part of the industry that I absolutely hate, and it's one of the primary reasons I started AFM, because I don't need to do a mentorship. I actually have successful businesses. Like I haven't been pushed to the point where my own personal training isn't working anymore, so I'm going to have to go and do a mentorship. I don't need to do that, but I want to give back. And the amount of incredible coaches that we have that I work closely with on EIQ that just don't market themselves well enough. those are the people that I want to have the biggest impact in the fitness industry. And like, that's what I hope to see going forward, is that those people have that space, have that confidence to actually sell themselves. Because the truth is, it's one thing being a good coach, but you actually can never be a great coach unless you can market yourself. Because how can you work with people? And what we were speaking about at the start, like, you can't figure out, you can't hone your skill set. There's, you can read as many books as you want, and you can do as many courses as you want. If you're not working with real people to develop that skill and to learn from each of them, you will never be a great coach. So you need both of these things. But there's so many coaches, and I think part of it is the Dunning-Kruger effect of lack of confidence, because they know how much they don't know. And it's fine not to know things. There's a huge amount I still don't know. And I've been at it for 10 years, like more if you count my degree. But the point is, like, these people lack the confidence because they're aware of what they don't know. And then you get these people who know barely anything with ridiculously high levels of confidence, who have great sales skills, partly because they're unaware of their huge lack of ability in personal training and in getting people results and in their knowledge of nutrition and training, et cetera, that it's easier to sell from a place of like uber confidence, like that isn't merited in the slightest.
Well, I'm glad I said that, ESG. It's very, very nice. It's not even a rant. It's just a speech. We're called out as a speech. Yeah. So for me, I feel like the high ticket thing will hopefully die off. Regards to, yeah, because it's just like there's only so much money people have available, especially going through like hard times that they're gonna go through. As you said, it's just a pressure tactic, and most of it isn't really high ticket because it's 6 months worth of coaching.
Yeah,
split that per month. Oh, I'm around £200 per month, but I've just got another package to, and it's like I've just made £1,000. I'm like, yeah, that's, you're working for them 24/7 for the next 5 years for your bloody high ticket fee that you just want a screenshot of.
I don't think it's such a terrible thing to, for example, like to have, you know, have your access and have products that are accessible to people and training that's accessible to people, but also maybe have other sort of more premium options for people who want more than what they might get for that amount. Like, say, for example, if somebody does want, you know, if there are people that want to have more sessions per week, you wouldn't charge them the same amount as you would for somebody who you're writing a plan for, who's doing one PT session a week, but you're still writing the rest of their plan. So like, I just think that what's important is that the product that you're offering represents the value that yes, you are charging for it. And I think that I think that you have two extremes in the fitness industry from what I've seen. You have people who are ruthlessly confident in their own value, who are massively overcharging for an inferior product. And you have incredible coaches who are doing really good work with clients and getting incredible results and really helping people and giving people huge amounts of value that are charging absolute peanuts. And yeah, I think that...
I totally agree with your point, Mike, but that isn't what I think high ticket is. Like,
I agree. Yeah. Like,
okay. And I just want to distinguish that. Yeah. There's one thing being like, this is my one-to-one service and it costs a bit more because you're getting
more. This is your worth. Yeah. Fair exchange. It's absolutely fair exchange.
But the problem with high ticket, I think this is what Luke was getting at, is the pressure sell. The horrible sales tactics of essentially saying, you don't care about your health if you don't pay me this much money. What are your pain points? Like, how can I push those so that you feel so guilty about yourself that you're going to pay me this much? That is disgusting. Like, that's horrible to me. That's not what health and fitness is about.
They can't back up the fulfillment.
Charging more for like more time, that's absolutely fine.
And your former point there, Mike, where you're saying that people that are relatively inexperienced and they aren't actually offering a fair exchange in terms of value, but they are also bragging about basically coercing and being quite forthcoming and, well, let's frankly say,
this is how much I ripped off people this month.
Yeah, exactly. And it's not that they're offering extra. That's the bit that really doesn't sit well with me.
Yeah, but don't you know, you just have to perceive value. You just have to create the perceived value.
Yeah, see, that's the gross side. I hope people get back to, because I still think it sounds cheesy to say, just being bloody good at your job is the best thing you can do for your business. because your results and your service, you know, people should be singing from the rooftops about it.
What an unusual concept.
I know, but I almost, I'd love for it to come back to the more humanistic elements, because on, like, even the language around high ticket and just referring to people as like numbers. And I know this is like, this is marketing speak, but like even leads make me feel a bit uncomfortable. I don't often refer to people as clients. Like I refer to them as people I work with. I'm a real stickler for language, and I know that's my issue, but I hope that, you know, people get back to just being the best possible thing for their job.
Yeah. I see more screenshots of Stripe payment things now than I see actual results with clients.
Mm.
I mean, which that's the
so grotesque. And also, like, I think it's not the only way to show these things. Like, if you want to show you're doing well, like, we've had 4,000 people on the EC method. Like, that's a win. Not, yeah, here's my bank balance. Like, that's just... No.
Do you know, can I give you a very slight tangent? I'm quite interested in this. I think a lot about this because I find proclamations of, like, public proclamations of wealth, I find incredibly uncomfortable, and I think grotesque, just like Em says. And I was watching a video recently about how there's a big movement in like luxury brands to be selling like stuff that looks cheap but that is more expensive, because people are becoming more embarrassed about their wealth because of what's going on in the world, because people are understanding more about poverty, but they're not willing to actually be poor. They don't want to actually like not be wealthy, but it makes them feel more comfortable if they're not wearing flashy designer clothes and they're looking really wealthy and admitting and demonstrating their wealth to other people. So there's this uprising in, and I can't remember what the term was for the, for these brands.
Can you buy like a 50 grand I don't know, like Ford car or something now?
No, but it's stuff like, I mean, even like
taking your Asda bags to shop at Waitrose,
like the Balenciaga type, you know, the ones that are like the play on the Tesco logo, but actually it's a designer t-shirt for £500, and all of these other sorts of brands that are like, well, so you know,
is it meant to be like only other rich people will know that this costs £500 for a t-shirt,
like a secret handshake?
I think it's like, and it's possible because it's like, I don't know, there's just this fashion of being, of not being rich, but actually you're still being rich, you're just not,
it's like, all demonstrating status,
understated,
isn't it?
Yeah.
It's status. Like when the world isn't going through hard times, they don't really care. Like their status is, I want to be seen as the rich person. Mm. And then they go, actually, now I want my status to be seen as one of the people, but I don't want to rub it in. But yeah, behind the door, behind closed doors, I don't give a fuck about anything. But for the public perception, I want to be seen as someone that isn't being flashy at this moment because of the hard times. Still status. It's just the status they want.
I think status chasing is a whole nother podcast. And I think that's probably a good place to wrap it up, because I feel like we can just chat about this stuff forever. Luke, thank you so much for your time, mate. We very much appreciate you. Thank you. I've said to you in private, I will now say in public, thank you for coming out of your little cave and sharing your knowledge and yourself with the world again, especially in the fitness space, because you've been missed.
Thank you. Well, you can't let all these fakes take over and then let the OGs in the background. So it's like, sometimes I'm just going to come out to be ready.
And thank you for your incredible talk at Level Up and for the trip.
And for my brownie.
It was we voted it 7 and then we adjusted it to a 6.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But no, I really enjoyed it.
Great after effect, didn't it?
And just in close, is there anything you want to leave our listeners with in terms of directing them to you, the business, where to find you, where to find out about products, services, etc.?
Yeah, just go ptcollective.com, the website. There's links there. And then Luke Johnson, PTC. I'm sort of a micro influencer. I'm giving myself that title now. So I'm tagging the story today with other people going, these are my favorite accounts. And this, I was tagged under the business element. I said, thank you very much. This has been a long time since I had one of these. So again, I think Mike said before, it's like sometimes it's like you try and be quiet and you go to a Level Up event, which was a fantastic event, ESG in the media. It was good to have a fitness event where it wasn't full of just men. And it was it was a good mix, but it was just so good to have that. And props to ESG for coming up with the title. And apparently I'm funny. And when you're funny, you get followers. So.
Well, you're so welcome. It was an incredible talk.
And if you have enjoyed today, please rate, review, share, tag us on Instagram and all that stuff. Because the only reason and the only way it hits other people's ear holes is if you share it around and tell other people how much you've enjoyed it.
Exactly.
Thanks.
Bye.
Bye.